It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. For decades, babysitting was a common first job for teenagers, especially girls and young women. For a lot of young babysitters, it might have gone something like this. You get old enough to watch your own siblings, maybe, while your parents had a night out, could experience heating up dinner, putting kids to bed. That if you liked babysitting or wanted to make some pocket money, you could get jobs with other families, making a couple few bucks an hour. But according to our next guest, the teen babysitter may be starting to become a thing of the past. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you used to babysit when you were younger? How old were you when you got that first babysitting gig? What was that experience like? If you're a parent today, do you hire the neighborhood kid for a babysitter for your kids? Why or why not? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Faith Hill is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she recently published a piece on the rise and fall of teen babysitting in the U.S. It's called Don't Tell America the Babysitter's Dead. Faith, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much.
Let's start with the present day, Faith. I don't think there's a federal department of babysitting with really precise stats, but it seems pretty convincing, the picture you paint. Babysitting seems to be on the decline, the teen babysitter. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, just as you say, it's hard to track this precisely because babysitting is so informal by definition. But the people who've been kind of studying this qualitatively do think that a lot of adults today just, want older people watching their kids or, sort of more professional childcare. And part of that is just that we, tend to see kids as sort of fragile and needing a lot of oversight today as part of this sort of intensive parenting trend. And that affects, teens too, or the kids we would have thought of as teens in the past. It used to be common for people to babysit at 12 or 13. And now, a lot of people don't want to leave their kids home alone at all until they're 12 or 13 or even older. It's just the way we see kids and teens is really changing. As a part of that, the sort of way we structure their lives. A lot of kids are in scheduled activities where they wouldn't need a babysitter. And teens themselves are often in those extracurriculars too, kind of worrying about, getting into college or exploring a career path more than kind of getting the sort of responsibility and, pocket money that they might have from babysitting in the past.
You point out in your piece the babysitter was a big part of pop culture for a long time. Here's a moment from the 1992 TV series, The Babysitter's Club. The leader of the group, Christy, gets the idea to start a babysitter's club after talking to her mom about trying to find a last-minute sitter.
I still can't get a sitter.
What about Sam?
Math club.
Charlie?
Football practice.
I'm babysitting for the Newtons.
Mm-hmm.
What about Marianne?
Busy. Everybody is busy.
I'm really sorry you keep having this problem, Mom.
Oh, it's not your fault, sweetie. It's just that I work too hard to have to spend so much time trying to find a sitter.
Now, the Babysitter's Club presented babysitting in a pretty positive light. That's not the only way it's been portrayed, but can you talk about what people saw the value of babysitting for that growing tween to teenager being?
Yeah, so back in the kind of heyday of babysitting, when it was something a lot of kids and tweens and teens were doing, there was so much cultural anxiety about it. Because, we did see teens and especially teen girls as kind of like on the cusp of adulthood. And there was a lot of kind of worry about how trustworthy they were and, whether you should leave your kids alone with them. And so sort of leading up to the Babysitter's Club and this kind of super sitter trend, was a lot of, sort of portrayals of badly behaved babysitters, kind of teens, seducing the father when the mom was gone, or a lot of horror movies with kind of like irresponsible babysitters then, trapped in a house with a killer and not protecting the kids. So in that sort of context, and the historian Miriam Forman Brunel has written about this, she sort of places it in that context where parents were worried about teens and babysitters, but they still needed babysitters. They needed people to watch their kids. So the Babysitters Club was kind of a way to set a model for teens to be well-behaved and also competent and have this sort of contained freedom of babysitting. And it was also very comforting to parents. So it was kind of this back and forth and ongoing tug of war about, you know, sort of how trustworthy teens were and how we should feel about babysitters.
You talk to historians about the rise of the age of the teen babysitter. And part of the change that was going on there was if it was a mom and dad family, it wasn't just dad who would go out at night for leisure time activities. Mom might as well. This was wrapped up in a very big social change in the first half of the last century.
Yeah, it was a really big change. And, you know, starting kind of in the 1920s, leisure really changed and sort of blossomed. Like, there were new technologies that made chores easier, so it freed up couples' time a lot. Wages were growing, and people were going out to restaurants and movie theaters, you know, with that increased disposable income. Car ownership was growing, too. So all of a sudden, yeah, it was not just men, but women who were also going, you know, to spend their leisure time out of the house. And that was a big change. And you can see it was one that, you know, people were very anxious about. It was kind of like, what's going to happen to the kids when mom is not in the house? So it was, yeah, an exciting time, but a time of great change. And it was also, you know, the ways that the child care methods that people had relied on in the past were changing. So, you know, grandparents were also enjoying social lives of their own. And they were affected by these leisure trends, too. And that meant that they weren't as much around to watch kids like they used to. So that was sort of the birth of the babysitter.
Talking to Faith Hill from The Atlantic about the rise and fall of the era of the teenage babysitter. Love to hear from you if you have an experience to share, if you remember babysitting when you were younger, if you do it now, if you remember your babysitter from when you were a kid, and if you're a parent today, the idea of hiring that 12 or 14-year-old neighborhood kid to take care of your kids, is that something you do, you would do, you'd be hesitant about? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Faith, every now and then on the internet, some job listing for a babysitter will go around. There was one that was like, must have master's degree, multilingual, blah, 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 gourmet chef, that kind of thing, you know, for a low wage. I think that might be extreme. But do we have higher expectations? Are there more credentials parents are looking for the person that's going to take care of their kids these days?
Yeah, I think a lot of parents do have higher expectations. You know, and that's part of the intensive parenting trend, too, is like a lot of parents are not just worried about their kids' physical safety, but also their, you know, future financial prospects and their sort of enrichment. They want their child to get ahead. And that really, it means that a lot of them want their kid to sort of be taking advantage of the time that they have. So where, you know, a babysitter in the past might have been, you know, placing the kid in front of the TV or just playing with them. Now, you know, researchers have found that a lot of parents are like looking for babysitters who can teach them another language or, you know, play the piano. And it's really like a totally different definition of what we would even talk about as babysitting.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Connie is with us in Portage. Connie, hi.
Hi. I babysat at 12 years old, probably for, I'm 85 now, and I babysat for four children when I was 12 because I lived in this small town and there was nothing else for girls to do to make money. So you did that when you were up into high school. And but I noticed the big change with my children now. They didn't want babysitters. They wanted grandma to take care of the kids. And most of their friends also. And it wasn't because of it. What all it was they were paranoid. They were afraid that something was going to happen to their children, which I thought was very strange. The whole I don't know, their whole generation. They're so worried about their kids. And then you heard about all these hovering patients or parents, and I've seen that with my own children. So if I would have been their child, I'd go nuts. They just constantly want to be in there. They go to their, the men would go watch their sons practice. We never heard of such a thing in the 50s. I mean, my boys would have been furious if their dad would have been sitting on the bleachers watching them practice.
Connie, thank you so much for sharing that. Faith, Connie is capturing the whole story you're telling in so many ways. What do you want to point in toward on Connie's story there?
Yeah, I think, thank you, Connie. You described it so perfectly. I think that really sums it all up. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's a sort of double-edged sword where, like, it's, you know, in some ways, these are good changes because it is true that, you know, on average, parents are spending more time with their kids than they used to. And, you know, one researcher pointed out to me, like, on average, like, kids probably are safer now than they used to be. But, you know, as you're saying, there's definitely a loss, you know, with everything so sort of structured and scheduled. And kids do really lose some element of freedom and sort of gaining responsibility over time.
Connie, thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Faith Hill, staff writer at The Atlantic. Her latest piece is under the headline, "Don't Tell America the Babysitter's Dead," about the changing role of babysitting in American culture. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your experiences as a babysitter, past or present, as a parent now, if you hire the local kid, the cousin, whatever, as a babysitter yourself. Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with staff writer Faith Hill from The Atlantic about her latest piece on the bygone era of teenage babysitters. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth is with us in Madison now. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Back in the 60s, I guess it would be, I loved when my mom and dad got us babysitters. We got special treats and snacks, and it was like a big deal. Then in the 70s, when I was in seventh and eighth grade, I began babysitting for 50 cents to a dollar an hour. A dollar was a big deal, sometimes three kids at a time. Nobody seemed worried about leaving their kids with me. But later, and it prepared me for my eventual career as a teacher, actually. So that was kind of fun. When I had my own child, actually, I don't think we ever hired a babysitter. We used grandma. So That's kind of the history of my babysitting experience.
Elizabeth, thanks for sharing that. And Faith, Elizabeth mentioned job skills related to becoming a teacher later. But this idea that this is a way for young people, especially young girls, to develop, you know, responsibility skills, whether they became teachers or not, this was viewed as kind of a job and responsibility training program in some ways.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think that was really special. You know, it was sort of a job that really would give you some responsibility, which felt good, but also in a, you know, it, as you say, it was kind of with training reels, like a starter job. And I think, you know, when you're young, it really is meaningful to start having someone trust you, and especially in a time when there's so much you can't control and you can't do. I think for a lot of teens, that was really meaningful growing up to, you know, start little by little, feeling like they could take on some responsibility. But yes, in this way, that was sort of also acknowledging their the way in which they were also childlike.
Thanks for sharing that experience, Elizabeth. Tasha joins us now in Green Bay. Tasha, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I started babysitting when I was 13, and then I babysat full-time in the summers when I was off school as a 14-year-old through high school, and so did all of my sisters who were older than me. I'm 30 now, so that was like in the 2000s. It was a really important experience, and I have a 2-year-old now who's babbling, and I don't think I would need that much qualifications from a kid to babysit him. I would just want to know them and know that they're like somewhat responsible to have them babysit my own 2-year-old.
And Tasha, I got to ask, is there a 12 to 14-year-old in mind who you could see they could be a babysitter, a niece or nephew or neighbor kid or something like that?
Not off the top of my head, but like I certainly know folks with kids. My generation's also just like not having as many kids. So like there aren't that, I feel like it's just like not as common now.
Sure.
Like I don't know as many people with kids that are around that age right now.
Tasha, thank you so much for telling us about that. And Faith, that reminds me, something that struck me in your piece is, you know, that parent now who might, like Tasha, be willing to hire that kid might not know that kid because we don't know our neighbors as well these days. Or as Tasha says, we don't have as many kids lying around here. How big a part of the change is that?
I think it's a really big part. And I was just thinking about that, too. You know, reporting this, I talked to a lot of people who, you know, said, I might trust a teen if I really knew them, but somehow the combination of seeing teens as quite young still, and also just not knowing that many teens often when we're adults, I think is a really big part of this. Babysitting used to be something that happened within communities, you know, it was like the teen that you had seen grown up and you knew who they were as a person. And it's a much bigger ask to, you know, ask parents to trust someone that they don't know that well, who's also young.
Tasha, thanks a lot for calling in. Jim joins us now in Portage. Jim, hello.
Hi, Rob. Rob, I'm 76 years old now, but when I was about 12, all the girls in the school were talking about the street fair coming to our little town and how they were all going to make a lot of money babysitting. So I thought I would be clever. I went down to the local newspaper and I put a classified ad in. I said, 12-year-old looking for babysitting jobs. And the phone rang off the hook day and night, people calling. But I never got a job as soon as they found out I was a male.
Wow. Jim, thank you for sharing that. And Jim brings up a big point there, Faith. This is super gendered. Like, I remember being a teenage boy. This is not on my radar at all. I don't think I was on anybody's radar to babysit. I was kind of an idiot anyway. But this is mostly girls we're talking about. Why such a huge gap there?
Yeah, it's so true. It is a big gap. And I think one reason for that is just that we do so associate caregiving with girls and women. And I think, you know, that came up a lot in reporting this piece, was just the way in which, you know, we have taken babysitting for so long as something so casual. And in some ways that was great, but it was also sort of assuming that, you know, parenting or caregiving comes naturally even to young girls. And one researcher I talked to had found that when she interviewed teen girls, they were actually like, you know, they wanted to do well at it and wanted to make money, but it wasn't this sort of like just immediate, intuitive, nurturing sense that we kind of, you know, have this idea that all girls and women feel. And sometimes that can lead to girls like not being paid enough for babysitting. So in some ways that was, you know, sort of a reason that some people I talked to felt it was good that babysitting is kind of formalizing a little bit and being taken more seriously.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. We're talking to Faith Hill, writer at The Atlantic, talking about the rise and what looks like the fall of the teen babysitter in American culture. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Rita is with us in Sorona. Rita, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, when I was like 13, 14, 15 years old, I had a full-time sitting job. I worked for a woman who worked second shift at a factory, and I got home from school, high school about 3:30. I got myself together, and I walked over to her house, and I got there about 3:15. She had me to work at food, and I'd be there for days.
Oh, you're breaking up, Rita, but I think we got the gist. Rita basically covered what sounds like a second shift at a factory, a full-time babysitting job. Faith, as you talk to researchers and others, was this pretty, are we usually talking about a couple few hours here and there, or did we see full-time babysitters a lot in the heyday of babysitting?
I think, you know, there was a lot of variation, but I got the sense that even if there were long hours, you know, a lot of young babysitters kind of felt like the situation was under control because the parents knew that they were young and it was this sort of job with training wheels. So, you know, a lot of them would be at the house for a long time, but by the time they got there, the kids would be put to bed, or, you know, the parents would put, you know, snacks for all of them or leftovers to heat up in the fridge. And so it was sort of, it's a really hard job, but it, you know, it's changed a lot, and it used to be kind of designed to be manageable for people who are still growing up.
Thanks for that call, Faith. And just our last minute or so, as you talk to people about babysitting, is there any sense that we're going to go back, that the teenage babysitter can make a comeback, or are we kind of locked into what we got now?
I think it's a really good question, and it's hard to say exactly, but I mean, my hope is that there can be some kind of middle ground found, because I can understand why parents would be nervous about hiring young people to watch their kids. And, you know, I think it's fair. And I do think, you know, childcare is hard, and it should be taken seriously. So it makes sense that we don't always see it so casually now. And, you know, we wouldn't want to go back to the 1950s in a lot of ways. But at the same time, I think it can be really meaningful for teens to start gaining responsibility beyond just, you know, the sort of test prep and extracurriculars, which are their own kind of responsibility. But I think there was something really unique and special about babysitting as kind of a rite of passage, both for the teens who did it and also for the kids, you know, who I think kind of got role models in teens who were, you know, old enough to be responsible, but young enough to be really cool in the kids' eyes. And I remember loving that.
Faith, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Faith Hill, staff writer at The Atlantic. We've been talking about her latest piece, Don't Tell America the Babysitter's Dead. Looks at the history of teen babysitting in the U.S. and how it's changed, risen, and fallen over the years. You can keep sharing your babysitting stories with us. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments this week in a case about the FDA's handling of the abortion medication mifepristone. A group of anti-abortion doctors and organizations filed a lawsuit claiming that the FDA violated the law when it expanded access to the drug in 2016 and 2021. Their original claim also challenged the initial approval of the medication. The justices haven't issued a ruling yet, but some of them sounded skeptical of the arguments and legal standing that brought the case to them. Here's Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson responding to some of the concerns brought up in the suit.
I see it that the injuries that the respondents allege, as you've articulated them, are conscience injury, that they are being forced to participate in a medical procedure that they object to. And so the obvious common sense remedy would be to provide them with an exemption, that they don't have to participate in this procedure. And you say, and you've said here several times, that federal law already gives them that. So I guess then what they're asking for in this lawsuit is more than that. They're saying, because we object to having to be forced to participate in this procedure, we're seeking an order preventing anyone from having access to these drugs at all.
If the court ruled against the FDA, it could limit access women have to the commonly used abortion drug across the country. It could have an impact on other FDA approvals. We're taking a closer look at these legal arguments and what impacts the court's decision could have. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about mifepristone and the Supreme Court case? Do you think the FDA should be allowed to keep making the drug widely available? Should it be available by mail, which is one of the issues at stake here? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel Ribeschet is the Peter J. Liacouras Professor of Law and Dean of the Beasley School of Law at Temple University. She researches reproductive health law and family law and has written extensively on issues related to mifepristone and medication abortion. Rachel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Before we head to the court, Rachel, can you remind us again what mifepristone is, how it fits into the abortion medication landscape?
Medication abortion is a set of pills, and it has two drugs. The mifepristone is the first drug. You take that before 10 or 12 weeks of pregnancy, and you follow that with the second drug, misoprostol, 24 to 48 hours later. Mifepristone is the only drug approved by the FDA to stop a pregnancy, to end a pregnancy, because it stops the pregnancy from developing. Misoprostol, the second drug, clears the uterus. And so they do different things, but they're usually prescribed together. And mifepristone is the drug at issue in this case and the first drug in a medication abortion.
And take us through the legal procedure. Who was challenging the FDA's approval? What exactly were they challenging in the early stages of this process?
So the litigation is brought by a group that formed shortly before it lodged its complaint, the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. It's a group of physicians who had joined together to contest that mifepristone is safe and to ask that the court in Amarillo, Texas, a federal district court, suspend FDA approval of mifepristone, which the FDA granted in the year 2000. They also claim that if the court decided that the FDA didn't err in putting mifepristone on the market in the first place, that the FDA was wrong to relax some of the restrictions on mifepristone in 2016 and in 2021. So there were multiple claims, but Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, their central argument is that medication abortion has caused more people to present at ERs, which then they, as physicians that work, some of them occasionally, some of them more frequently in ERs, are then required to treat and complete abortions for those patients. And that's the injury that they suffer. And that's the group that's taking this litigation. And as you noted in the quote, there's a lot of debate about the remedy they're asking for and whether or not they've suffered any injury at all, not being abortion providers, not being certified to prescribe medication abortion and the like.
That seems like it's been a big argument all through this process leading up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and that clip we played from Justice Brown Jackson. This not so much the question of abortion, good or bad, legal or illegal, but of standing of these physicians and should they have the right to be the ones challenging this in the first place? It's a little technical and legal sense, but how important a part of this is this?
It's crucial. And you're absolutely right. I think the justices asked a lot of questions about standing. So you don't get to the meat of the case without standing. We don't let people go to court and file a lawsuit and sue if they are not directly injured, if they are not a party that has the grievance in which they have felt the harm. So if there is a brawl and three people are in the brawl, but I'm standing next to it, and those three people might have claims for assault or battery or the like, because they've been in the fight, but I don't get to claim assault because I was standing next to a fight and saw it happen. That's a really rough way to describe standing, but you need it in every case. And there's different kinds of standing and lots of different doctrines of how you establish it. But the core issue here is that the doctors who make up Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, I think, as I mentioned, they do not provide abortions. They do not see abortion patients. They do not work for abortion clinics. They are not working at hospitals that have an abortion practice of which they participate. Their claim is that medication abortion increases the likelihood that there will be patients that arrive in ERs, which they might have to treat. And so the Solicitor General made the argument that that's too attenuated. There are too many things that they have to happen for someone to be directly implicated. And where Justice Barrett spent a lot of time, for instance, is saying, you know, even asking about conscience provision, refusal. So even if you're in a place where someone needs emergency care and that care involves an abortion, there are laws that protect your right to not provide care that you have religious or moral objection to. And so, you know, that standing relates, this question of injury relates to the remedy problem, because, you know, what they're claiming is their injury, which should give them standing. You know, there's a gap between what would solve the injury, refusing to provide care you object to, with what they're asking for, taking a drug off the market for everyone to use. So there's it's bound, standing is key, and it's bound up with a lot of different issues in the case.
Talking to law professor Rachel Ribouchet from Temple University, looking at the mifepristone medication abortion case, came before the U.S. Supreme Court this week. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Hi. So I wonder if you could maybe explain. I've heard that there is this Texas connection where all of these respondents have kind of coalesced around, I believe it's Amarillo in Texas, and all cases filed in that district fall before one specific judge who seems to be very receptive to these arguments irrespective of standing.
Chris, thanks for the call. He's referring to U.S. District Judge Matthew Kaczmarek in Amarillo, a household name in people following these stories. That also puts it in the Fifth Circuit, known as a fairly conservative circuit court, on its way to the Supreme Court. Rachel, how important is the selection of judges in cases like this?
Well, I think it's been pretty important. You know, Texas, their district courts have a rule that, and, you know, that the cases where, you know, the case is heard where it's filed, and they have a number of single court districts. So what I mean by that is they have a district in which there's only one judge. And so if you file in Amarillo, and I think the caller is correct that Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine is a fairly new organization, it formed in Amarillo, and it formed likely and explicitly, I think that this has been reported on, so that it could take this case in Amarillo. And there's only one judge in Amarillo. So if you file in Amarillo, you're gonna get before Judge Kaczmarek. And, you know, I think that there's a lot outside the abortion context being thought about, talked about, written about, judge shopping and forum shopping. It happens in patent law, for instance, in the state of Texas. But in this case, I think it was purposeful. I think that's a really fair assumption that Alliance formed as an organization in Amarillo for the purpose of being able to take this case before the court that Judge Kaczmarek sits.
Chris, thanks for that call. Talking to Rachel Ribouchet from Temple University Law School, looking at how the FDA has administered the abortion pill mifepristone, big U.S. Supreme Court case on that. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about abortion medication, about this legal challenge to it, your hopes, your fears for what comes out of the U.S. Supreme Court. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Rachel Ribouchet, law professor and dean of the Beasley School of Law at Temple University, with us today to explain an ongoing U.S. Supreme Court case about the FDA's rules around the abortion drug mifepristone. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Rachel, you wrote a piece about factual claims being made on both sides of this case, and you've referenced one of them a couple times. The plaintiffs here are starting with the point that mifepristone is bringing more people to emergency rooms, questioning the safety as part of that. Can you talk about those claims and what we know about them?
You know, one of there's been now a lot of review of the research that Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine offered to suggest that people who are taking mifepristone are increasingly large proportion of the people who are arriving at ERs, and they extract from that these safety claims. But a lot of that has been debunked, that people who are arriving at ERs after taking mifepristone, they're often, the research isn't detailing what their cause for going to an ER is. Is it an adverse reaction to the drug? Is it some other condition? Is it something unrelated to the medication abortion entirely? The research also doesn't seem to, distinguish. So it said another way, the research isn't distinguishing the reasons mm-hmm. for going to an ER. And the government, the FDA, and the Danco, the manufacturer of Mifprex, the brand name for mifepristone, they have a lot of research, countless studies that demonstrate that mifepristone is a really safe drug. What's a little strange about the litigation is that mifepristone has a very strong track record of safety and efficacy, but it's one of the most regulated drugs on the market. So far from being too loose in regulating or restricting mifepristone, the FDA has imposed limits on its distribution and on its prescription in ways that it does not do for drugs that have a similar or worse safety profile than mifepristone. So I think that's a lot of people are watching this litigation because there's a contestation of what is the safety record for mifepristone. The safety has been on pretty solid ground, and there are now these emergent studies that seek to question it. And you have at least the Fifth Circuit and a district court in Amarillo, Judge Kosmarek, that are willing to say, any doubt is reason to doubt what the FDA decided. And so I guess it's worth also repeating that, the FDA has an onerous process for putting drugs on the market. Pharmaceutical companies and others spend billions of dollars in research and development in order to comply with FDA standards, in order to get drugs on the market. And, it's not surprising that one group that's watching this litigation very closely is pharma, which came out very strongly against the decision by Judge Kosmarek. What does it mean to invest years and years and years, decades of research on drug safety, to have a court almost 25 years later say, no, the FDA was wrong?
Let's go back to our callers. We've got Rachel on the line in Milwaukee. Rachel, hello.
Hello.
Go ahead, Rachel.
I just, was calling as a female in support of hoping that this measure does not go any further. As a female with a daughter, maybe granddaughter someday, it's very concerning, the amount of medical decisions that are being stripped away from us as females with our doctors, with medical, degrees and educational backgrounds. It's scary to me, actually, to be totally honest, but I just am calling and, a female in support of, hoping that this measure goes no further. And it's very even more concerning how these groups can just form and, challenge these things in such a conservative district with a judge that obviously leans one way. Mm-hmm. And that creates policy that can affect my health.
Sure. And Rachel, thanks a lot for the call. Rachel Rebouchet, I won't ask you to predict what the Supreme Court is going to do, whether they come out in favor of what Rachel's hoping for. But from what you saw, what you heard in the questioning, what are you thinking as far as how the justices might make a decision?
I think there's a lot of, at least from what I heard from the oral argument, what I've read others' takes on it, I think that there is There's reason to think that there is a majority of the court, so at least five votes, that think that standing, that the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine should not have standing in this case. And if you don't have standing, then you don't get to the question of did the FDA do the wrong thing, because you can't take the case in the first place. And from the questions I heard, I think there's a lot of skepticism that these physicians experienced any direct injury because of medication abortion being on the market. And any injury they may have experienced is injury that ostensibly can be addressed by refusing, conscientious objection. So I do think that there is a good chance the Supreme Court could rule against the Alliance on the standing argument. If they clear that hurdle and they get to the core issues of the case, did the FDA err? Did it act arbitrarily and capriciously when it loosened the restrictions on mifepristone taking effect after 2016 and then after 2021 being finalized in 2023? It's probably too in the weeds to get into now what exactly those changes were. But for my money, I think this case is entirely about mailed medication abortion. That last change was on the back of the pandemic. The FDA lifted the restriction that people had to pick up mifepristone in person at a healthcare facility. Even though they could take it anywhere they wanted, they didn't have to consume it in the presence of a provider. You know, the 20,000 drugs that the FDA regulates, mifepristone was the only one that you had to pick up at a healthcare facility, but you could take in the privacy of your home or anywhere you chose without provider oversight. And there were lots of studies conducted over decade or two in various countries, including ours, that showed that there really was no safety benefit. There was no harm reduction, that it was a superfluous restriction. And lifting it permanently has allowed virtual clinics, for instance, to proliferate, to thrive. And so these are clinics that are not brick and mortar clinics. They exist only online. You log on, you have counseling that's synchronous or asynchronous. You do informed consent process. It takes about 2 to 3 days from start to finish. Then pills are mailed to you. It's hundreds of dollars less expensive than a medication abortion at a clinic. So, I think that's at the heart of this case. And my prediction is if there's a majority of the court that doesn't think that standing is a problem, there might be a majority of the court that zeroes in on that rule change as being problematic.
And Rachel, we just have a minute left. Some people have seen some foreshadowing references to the Comstock Act from the late 1800s that restricted lots of things, including birth control by mail. Do you see that as a potential next front of challenging abortion in the U.S.? Again, just in our last minute.
Yeah, absolutely. Comstock's not going anywhere. It's an 1873 law that makes it a federal crime to mail anything, any drug, any instrument, anything. The act actually says thing. That is part of an abortion. So that's definitely pills. It's definitely any gloves you would order to, for a clinic. It could be a de facto nationwide abortion ban. And so if Comstock is applied as in the way that, for instance, the Heritage Foundation says it should be, it revives an over 150-year-old law to be a ban, even for states in which where abortion is legal now.
Rachel, we'll leave it there and probably talk to you about that again in the future. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Rachel Ribouchet, the Peter J. Liakouras Professor of Law and Dean of the Beasley School of Law at Temple University. She is with us today to talk about the U.S. Supreme Court case over how the FDA has handled the abortion drug mifepristone. Coming up tomorrow on the morning show, play ball. Major League Baseball and the Brewers season start up this week. Get a preview and join in with your hopes and dreams for the 2024 campaign. You can get things started right now with an email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Are you excited about baseball this year, about Brewers baseball in particular? You're going to try to make it to the home opener. Are you a lifelong fan? You could share some of your favorite moments and disappointments along the way. Again, email ideas@WPR.org and then join that baseball conversation that's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we'll get great ideas for brunch recipes that we can make at home. Great for any time or for holidays that happen at brunch time, like often Easter, upcoming Mother's Day, which reminds me, for a few years, this is a while back, I celebrated Mother's Day with my wife and kids and mother-in-law by going out to a restaurant for brunch. I was in charge, so that meant scrambling at the last minute to find a place with reservations open because I'm not a plan-ahead kind of guy. It always worked out. It was always, okay, decent brunch food, crowded restaurants. But I found out nobody really liked going out to Mother's Day brunch all that much. They all wanted something home-cooked instead, which is great for me because I'd rather cook something than go out on a busy holiday. And brunch, in some ways, it's the easiest meal. Hard to go too wrong. So I'm looking forward to this brunch edition of Food Friday tomorrow for some more inspiration on making awesome home brunches. You can share your favorite brunch food. Email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama blocked the promotions of more than 400 military officers for nearly 10 months last year. Tuberville was protesting a Biden administration policy allowing paid leave for some service members seeking abortion services. He eventually allowed those promotions to go forward. But our next guest says that's just one recent example of lawmakers drawing the military into partisan political debates. She writes that it's time for elected officials and armed forces leadership to rededicate themselves to the nonpartisan ethic that's defined their relationship and that the public trust and national security are at stake. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see lawmakers putting more pressure on military leaders or the Defense Department's appointees? How important is it to you that those people stay out of party politics? Do you think that's still possible these days? If you've served in the armed forces, what did that nonpartisan ethic mean for you? What did it look like? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Risa Brooks is a professor of political science at Marquette University and a non-resident senior associate in the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She's the author of the book Shaping Strategy, The Civil-Military Politics of Strategic Assessment. Her recent piece in Foreign Affairs magazine is called The Creeping Politicization of the U.S. Military. Risa, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Before we get into the warning signs you're seeing, let's start with what things are supposed to look like. What is the relationship between military leadership and our elected and appointed officials supposed to work like?
Yes, that's important. So we start out with the Constitution and the principles that it enshrines. And essentially, if you boil that down, what it says is that elected political leaders have final say over what the military does, how it's run, and when it's used. At the same time, they also have obligations to listen to military advice and respect its political neutrality and nonpartisanship. The military has an obligation to serve society as a whole, and while doing that, it is supposed to, its members, its leadership in particular, is supposed to advise civilians, help make decisions in a way that reflects the interests of the country as a whole and not their own personal partisan political views. So that's how it's supposed to work.
It might seem obvious, but why? Why was that such an important core founding principle that stuck around? It is still around today. Why is that so important?
Yes. Yeah, so the military, the underlying idea is the military is not the elected leadership itself, right? The American people elect political leaders to serve their interests, and they get to make those decisions because they've been voted in. The military doesn't have that kind of privilege or role according to the Constitution. And for that reason, it's not supposed to be advocating for a particular policy or opinion, and its personnel are supposed to remain out of those kinds of contentious debates or elections or anything like that.
We've seen over the last few decades, probably longer, politicians from both parties try to use the military maybe as a backdrop for their political campaigns, to use the concept of the troops for politics. But you see something different going on, I think, just in the last maybe decade or so, coming from a particular part of a particular party, the Republican Party. What do you see happening that worries you?
Sure. So what I call politicization of the military, drawing the military into situations that are partisan in nature or into debates about contested issues, isn't actually very new. It starts sort of in the 1990s when the military emerges after the Vietnam era and is sort of rebuilt and becomes very popular. And it remains that way, in fact, for decades at the top of the list of institutions in which Americans have confidence in, very popular. And with that, naturally, politicians have tried to sort of borrow on that popularity. So, you know, have military personnel in the background of a speech, or, you know, try to associate themselves with the military in some way. And this sort of form of politicization has been around for a long time. What's different now is it used to be that politicians would sort of praise the military, and now you see a lot more criticism. And in some quarters, you know, downright really disparaging commentary, especially about senior military leadership and the country's officers. And that sort of twist of criticism, combined with a lot more sort of assertive uses, drawing the military into these sort of central political debates, is really a shift. And has come from, as you mentioned, not every part of the political spectrum. It's really people in a particular side of politics on the right side of the Republican Party, some people might describe it like that, that are really pushing in this particular way.
What are some of the messages that worry you the most coming, say, from members of Congress?
Yeah, I think the messages that worry me personally are when I think about what the country's adversaries see when some of these politicians, senators, et cetera, members of Congress, say things like the U.S. military is weak, it's not focused on its correct priorities, its military leadership is, you know, I'm not going to use all the phrases, but, you know, really ugly things sometimes are being said about them, that they don't care about the institution, that they're just concerned with the military-industrial complex, things like this. I think that's really bad because of the signal it says sends internationally. I think it's also really bad for morale potentially in the military. And it's overall just not a good thing for the unity of the institution to have people disparaging its top leadership like this. So I find it extremely concerning. And I think that so far, the U.S. military has withstood a lot of these pressures, but it's growing and increasingly worrisome.
One of the main messages that I think leads to some of what you're talking about is accusations that the military is, to use the commonly used phrase, woke, meaning if someone promotes concerns about racism in the military or blocking white supremacist infiltration of the military, the accusation that that is wokeness of some kind and that leads to weakness of some kind. Is that one of the fronts you're watching most closely?
Yes, it's actually a really common refrain these days. And I just to cite one statistic, there was a study that was done that found that there had been 87,000 references to the so-called woke military. What's odd about that is that the U.S. military has always been concerned with equal opportunity in the ranks, and nothing has really changed in what it does. So this is more a perception or a an idea that's being spread from the political side and not from within the military. While you can probably, you know, the military is large, there's a lot of different people in it. While I'm sure you can find people that have concerns about personnel policy or the like within the ranks, for the most part, this isn't a concern coming from the military. It's something being used in sort of wedge politics by certain politicians that are trying to demonstrate or appeal to their constituencies by sort of lambasting the military for policies which aren't really much different than they've been for decades.
We're talking to Risa Brooks, professor of political science at Marquette University, expert on military-civilian relationships. She recently wrote about concerns about the politicization of the U.S. military for Foreign Affairs magazine. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about the military getting drawn into partisan politics, whether members of the military want to be drawn in or not? Do you have concerns about it getting worse in a potential second Trump administration? We'll talk about that in a couple. Join in with your thoughts, questions, maybe experiences in the military yourself. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Risa Brooks, political science professor at Marquette University, expert on civilian-military relations. In a recent piece, she wrote that politicians, she worries, are pulling the armed forces into partisan politics. That's ultimately dangerous for national security. You could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Risa, we started with Congress. Let's turn to the White House now. You have concerns about a potential second Trump administration based in part on what you saw at the end of the first, and so far only, Trump administration. What happened in 2020, 2021 that has you concerned?
Sure. So some of your listeners may recall that when Donald Trump was first elected, he had a bit of a love affair with the military. He appointed a lot of retired generals, including his Secretary of Defense, to his cabinet. And that faded over time, in part because some of the things that he wanted to do with the military were controversial. Among the most notable was in June 2020, when after George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, some of you will remember, Donald Trump wanted to actually send regular military, not National Guard, active duty military to confront protesters in the street. And the military did not think this was a good idea for multiple reasons and pushed back. So by the end of the term, the last few months, actually after Donald Trump had lost the election, he made some changes. He fired his Secretary of Defense. He put in a few officials that didn't have a great deal of experience for the jobs that they were given in the Pentagon. And since that time, on numerous occasions, he's talked about his regrets that he hasn't had a more deferential, both civilian and military leadership in the Pentagon. I think there are, if you just listen to the things that he says, there may be some real pressures on the military not to act as this impartial actor that gives advice based on it, what it thinks is the best interest of the country, but to find people to serve in top leadership roles that will protect the interest of Trump as a politician, which is contrary to the tradition of this country, contrary to the sort of fundamental premise of democratic civil military relations.
We know the president can appoint the Secretary of Defense a key role in the defense system. What kind of authority does the president have when it comes to appointing the top military officers in the country?
Yeah, so ultimately, at the very end of the day, the president has a lot of power both to put pressure on the senior most, the top level of the general officer corps and the senior military leadership. He could presumably say, I don't have confidence in you. Will you please resign? Or even potentially fire them. The Senate does oversee a lot, senior officer, mid-grade officer promotions. They also have influence. But even if they asserted that influence, you're just going to get a big mess around something that's usually routine. people are usually promoted, put into those top positions because of their careers, their talent, their experience, not because they check a particular ideological box.
If that changed, and if those top military appointees were put there because they tick an ideological box or vow, in effect, personal loyalty to the president, regardless of, say, constitutional safeguards, what do you see as a potential worst case?
I think that, you know, one of the implications that I think is concerning is really at the very top. You know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, by law, is the president's principal military advisor, you know, the person that's supposed to tell them the implications of different national security plans, of using the military in wartime. And you want somebody in that position who has a deep sense of their commitment to their oath to support and defend the Constitution and to serve the American people as a whole and to protect the entire national security interests of the country. Not to be thinking about, well, if we use the military in this way, it might be an advantage to you electorally or appeal to this constituency. They're supposed to advise the president about tough decisions. And that's why that nonpartisan ethic, that impartiality, is so important to the country's security. And that's for both true for Democrats and Republican presidents. They both need impartial military advice to best serve the country.
What do you want to hear from American political leaders here at sea from American political leaders when it comes to restoring this nonpartisan ethic in the military?
Sure. Well, I think that they need to stop putting the military in between their own policy disputes. You mentioned the situation with Alabama Senator Tuberville and, you know, him holding up for nearly 10 months over 400 military promotions, which creates huge bottlenecks and, you know, keeps service members from moving and their families. It's really, you know, a big mess. And this is a dispute between Senator Tuberville and his allies and other supporters and the Biden administration, which is making the policy to allow service members to get reimbursed if they have to travel, if they do travel to a state to get an abortion where it's illegal, where they are now based. That's a policy dispute between politicians. Holding the military that doesn't have any control over those kinds of policies in the middle of that is really bad. So they shouldn't be doing that. They should also just try to not be disparaging of the military, to just kind of leave it to the side to do its job. And I'll just add that for them to have the incentive to do that, the public has to support that. If the public rewards these kinds of shenanigans, politicians have more incentive to do that. So even if you hear a general or you think you might want the country's generals to say things that you agree with, that's not healthy and that's not good. And it creates bad incentive structures for politicians. So we as the public need to abstain from doing that, even if it might feel good in the moment.
Risa, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Risa Brooks is a professor of political science at Marquette University and an associate in the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We talked with her about her recent article for Foreign Affairs magazine about the dangers of politicizing the U.S. military. There's a presidential primary coming up in Wisconsin, but voters in our swing state are finding that some of the political fervor they're used to is missing. That's because President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump secured the Democratic and Republican nominations for president weeks ago. As Sean Johnson reports, their November rematch has some voters uneasy.
On a recent Saturday, the inside of the Waukesha Expo Center is filled with vendors selling a little bit of everything at an event called Rummage-O-Rama. There are tables full of vintage clothes, furniture, and toys. Another sells steel oil cans, still full. For shoppers and vendors, this is fun. They're a little less excited to talk about politics. When asked about the upcoming April primary, some, like Gary Wolenzine of Waukesha, say they don't like either of the candidates. Wolenzine thinks Biden has spent too much money. He calls Trump a schoolyard bully. Wollendine would typically vote Republican. This year, he may not vote at all.
That may be the first time I have not voted for a president in an election because they're both incompetent and not presidential material.
Rachel Cartwright of Oak Creek says she's also not sure either candidate is up to the job. For the first time in her life, she says she's afraid to even talk about who she supports in politics.
You know, we can't just calmly speak on who we believe in. That I think has made this whole process a lot more difficult than it used to be.
A Waukesha voter named Kathy, who would only give her first name, says her sons no longer talk because of politics. There won't be third-party candidates on the ballot in April, but she'll consider them in November.
There has to be somebody else out there. I'm the eternal optimist, and I gotta believe there's somebody. I don't care if it's a Republican or a Democrat, but there's gotta be somebody else out there.
Not everyone is this unhappy with the current state of politics. But this snapshot of voters in swing state Wisconsin is more than just anecdotal. Trump and Biden both have negative approval ratings here. And in the last few Marquette University Law School surveys, pollster Charles Franklin says between 17 and 20% of voters had negative views of both candidates.
That's more an expression of dissatisfaction today than it is a prediction of whether they will actually vote or not in November. But it certainly shows that for this group of 17 to 20% of the electorate, they are seriously considering sitting it out or voting for someone other than Biden or Trump.
On the April ballot, voters' options are limited. Six Republicans appear alongside Trump, but they've long since dropped out of the race. For Democrats, there's a push to get progressives to vote uninstructed. A stand activists say would send a message that Biden's position on the war in Gaza is unacceptable. For people who work in politics, like Democratic operative Joe Zepecki, the state of the race has their attention.
It's concerning, full stop. The electorate is unruly and people are frustrated.
Zepecki says the answer for Democrats is to highlight Biden's record and remind voters of Trump, including his role in trying to overturn the last election.
I believe that the vast majority of the American public has not yet tuned into this election, and that couple billion dollars in advertising and the stakes of this election are going to bring it home.
Not everyone needs that convincing. Back at the Waukesha rummage sale, Keith Best with the County Republican Party says Trump voters are excited about this year.
We're at different events like this. We see that so many people come up to us and they want to talk politics because they don't have anybody that they can talk with at home. Sometimes it's just they want to vent.
And Biden voter Linda Jordan of Milwaukee says there's a lot to like about the president. She thinks other Democrats will come around.
I think when it comes down to it, everyone, they'll come out. Those that are interested in their country, that are interested in politics, in our democracy, I believe they may feel that way, but in practice or whatever, I believe that they will come out.
It's one thing to complain about the candidates in April, Jordan says. In November, she thinks people will see the election in a different light. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, if you love to watch the weather, you can take another step. Check out a Wisconsin citizen science program that brings the public on board to help make key measurements and observations. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday with some great inspiration for brunch menus for Easter or Mother's Day or any day. You can share your favorite brunch item right now. Email ideas@wpr.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.